Hello, everyone. This is John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com. Welcome to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. We have another fascinating program for you today. My guest today is Chuck Wright. And Chuck is a fascinating person with 30 years experience in law enforcement in both probation and as a parole officer, both within the state of Washington here in the United States. He is also a licensed mental health professional. And we met at the Springbrook Summit on Law Enforcement Wellness that was held recently in Portland, Oregon. But Chuck is now working through the law enforcement hotline, Safe Call Now. It's actually a hotline for first responders that are going through stress and need some help. But more fascinating in his background, Chuck has done all kinds of things. One specifically was work on the Green River Serial Killer Task Force a number of years ago, where a serial killer was suspected of 40 or more homicides. And following that, because of his background in mental health, was actually a lecturer for the FBI on mental health issues specifically in the people that work on task forces, because it can become so all-consuming. So without any further ado, Chuck, I really want to welcome you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, John. Hey, it's a privilege to be on your program. It was really a privilege to be at the summit, too.
Thank you. Why don't we start? I have a hard time doing an introduction of somebody who's got such an amazing background. So how about if you do it in your own words, maybe share with us a little bit about your background, your experience, and then maybe we'll talk about some of the mental health issues related to stress and law enforcement that brought us together.
Okay, yes, I will. I got my undergraduate from Portland State University in Oregon in sociology, applied to the state of Washington to become a probation pro trainee in 1970. And of course, I was all geared up to be a pro officer, the fun and games, get involved in some great cases and be able to be the focal point at cocktail parties and all. So I took the job. My first year, I became very interested in sexual deviancy and violence, and thought I need more education, so I applied to New York University under a federal LEAP program, mm-hmm. paid for my education, and in turn I had to give 5 years back to the state, and went back there to New York University to get a degree, which I did eventually, an MA in Family Life, Human Sexuality, and Human Sexuality. Came back to the state of Washington, became a sexpert, and started seeing more and more sex offenders. Yeah. I was a specialist in that field in violence for 2 years. Then Cielo University, which is a Jesuit Catholic school, asked me if I'd come and be a adjunct instructor and teach a class on sexual deviancy in the law in their law and justice program. Mm-hmm. I ended up doing that, and I taught several other courses for 19 years as an adjunct there. Wow. Anyway, I got to see more and more sex offenders, and then I started seeing the most bizarre sex offenders. Mm. And, of course, that was fun and games for me. And after about 6 years, I can remember one day I just lectured at Cielo University. I had the night classes. I was coming home, driving home. I had my window down in a normal Cielo day. It was raining. I had the radio on, and I heard on the news that somebody was raped. Now, I don't want to downplay rape, serious offense, but it was, oh, hum. Did the person stab and cut off the leg? Did they chew on the person? That's what's going through. And the window was down, the rain was coming in, and my face got wet. I reached up there to wipe it off, and I was crying. Mm. I was so out of tune. Here I was, a mental health person, out of my own feelings, that I didn't know I was crying. So when I got home, my wife saw me, and I was a disaster. She said, "You got to call. I'm going to call Chris Harris." Chris Harris is a psychiatrist friend of mine, mm-hmm. a forensic psychiatrist who I worked a lot with during my pre-sentence days. I got on the phone to Chris. And within a minute, not even that, 15 seconds, Chris gave me a diagnosis, which I didn't know was a diagnosis at the time. He says, Chuck, you're effed up. Bad. You need to see somebody. And I can't see you because I'm a friend, but I'm going to make an appointment for you tomorrow to go in and see a psychiatrist friend of mine. I went in to see the guy. And, of course, he knew nothing about law enforcement and the crap that we hear and see daily.
Yeah.
I went to him, and it took me 2 months before I started trusting the guy because I had to explain things to him, what this meant, what pre-sentences were, you know. And then about the third month, I went to him, and I said, before I went, I said, damn it, I'm going to tell him what's in my mind. And I got in there and sat down, and I said, Doc, I'm going to tell you what's in my mind. And I was thinking suicide 16 hours a day.
Wow.
I didn't tell people that. I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed with all the violence that was inside me that I didn't see it, but I read about it. I read the cases. I saw the pictures. And the secondary traumatization, which I never knew about, was taking hold of me 5 years prior to this. And so anyway, I started telling them these stories. And I started crying. And I looked up, and the psychiatrist was crying. And I said to myself, you know, I'm not going to rescue him. I'm a rescuer, but I'm not going to rescue him. God damn it. He can take care of himself. I got to dump. I got to tell somebody what's going through my mind.
Yeah.
And I told story after story after story. And one of my nemesis was, they were paper people, but if somehow, somewhere in that process, they changed, those paper people changed to human beings. And at that point in time, I started falling apart. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it. That's what I call now a yellow light before the red one comes on.
Yeah.
And so I started talking, and then I bawled. And let me tell you, John, there's a difference between crying and bawling. I bawled for about 40 minutes. Of all the inhuman things that I had heard about, read about, and pictures I saw,
mm-hmm.
and I dumped. And when I got up after that session, I could hardly walk. I was exhausted. But I felt better. I felt better that I could talk to somebody about what was going on. One of my problems was I didn't tell my wife about it because I wanted to protect her.
Yeah.
By not telling her some of these stories, not the gore, but what I was going through, I destroyed my marriage. I didn't protect it. I destroyed it.
Yeah.
When I got out of there, I felt 1,000% better. I thought about the psychiatrist. You know, I'm having to go to a psychiatrist after I got through with him. that was his thing, not mine.
Yeah.
Within 2 months, I was off my medicine because I was taking medication for my suicidal ideations, my agitation, my depression, my anxiety, and I was off of it. And that was back in 83. And I was really considered myself one of the hidden victims of these offenders.
Yeah.
I was concerned that if I got back into it, that I would crash and burn again. But I started writing down what I considered, again, my yellow lights, that I had to start taking care of myself when these lights go on. Then when the Green River thing came around, which was about 10 years later, I'm back in my mind, I was thinking, can I do this? Can I do this? And I was scared. Well, I mean, that's kind of exaggerated, scared. But I was concerned that I was going to crash and burn again.
Uh-huh.
But I went through it, and I didn't crash and burn because I knew what I had to do to take care of myself. I had divorced, so that resource was out of the picture.
Right.
And I didn't want to go through that crap again, nor did I want to go through the pain of keeping all those gore stories inside me. So eventually I came out of it, and then I went to the Arson Task Force, and that was a six-month task force, and I made it through that. But then they started using me my skills as a, I'll say, person with person skills, because a lot of cops don't like mental health people because we're one step above defense attorneys, you know. So I understand that. So I don't use, I try not to use mental health. A person with person skills.
Yeah.
They started using me on the task force to work with detectives, investigators, and to help them through it, after they testified. Mm-hmm. Had to bring up all this crap again.
Right.
After that, as you pointed out to your audience, 2 months later, because of my unique role, I was asked to go back to the FBI Academy to talk to them about having a person with person skills on task forces to work with investigators. But mm-hmm. the one thing we forgot about was the families.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking about family. We need the people on task forces who know the task force. They know the secret information. They walked the streets with the officers mm-hmm. and to work not only with them, but also the family members. Because too often, the investigators, they come home and their body's home, but their mind's not home. And that causes a lot of problems. They go to a soccer game, let's say, and the wife says, well, you haven't watched Johnny play soccer for over a year now. And Sally, our daughter, wants you there at a game. So the person feels obliged, and rightly so, to go. But the body's there, and you can see the mind's not there because he or she's thinking about, we got to catch this guy before he kills another person.
Right.
And so the wife, her significant other, says, you're not going anymore anyway because you're not here. And so the fight goes on. But they need somebody to explain what's going on with these people. And sure, the body's there and the mind's not, because this is one of the reasons. But if we get somebody to work with both the family and the officers, maybe the body and mind can be there for at least an hour before it goes out.
Yeah.
I retired in 1999, but right after this, my role on the arson task force in 93, I became very interested in the critical incident response team.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed a mental health person, and I said, yeah, I can do that. And I became certified in the critical incident response Mitchell model, and since 93, I've been working with firefighters and 911 operators and cops under after a critical incident. I got a call after I retired about a year after from a friend of mine who is a detective, a homicide detective in Snohomish County, which is the third leading county in the state of Washington.
Right.
See if I would volunteer to be on their new cold murder case team.
Mm.
They like my background. They like my mental health background. I walk the streets. I've interviewed, by that time, not exaggerated, 10,000 sex offenders.
Wow.
At least, to my knowledge, 2 serial killers, to my knowledge.
Wow.
And so they said, geez, we can use this. And I thought, God, is this a yellow light for me? Well, I didn't tell this guy this, you know. I said, well, I made it through the other two. I guess I can make it through this. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And so for the last 5 years, I've been working with a cold murder case team once a week. And also, again, being a critical incident, the sheriff gave me a special deputy in that I am a peer for law enforcement. Now, peer in our state is a legal term.
Right.
It means I have privileged communication when I talk to police officers, sheriff deputies, and it usually has to do with a shooting or something where, of course, the lawyers don't want you to talk to anybody, but a peer, they'll let you talk to a peer because I have privileged communication.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sean gave me a call about 2 years ago. He's the founder of Safe Call, and says, hey, we heard from the sheriff that you've got this background. we need somebody with that type of attitude. Let's sit down and talk. So I did, and for the last 2 years, I've been the primary mental health person with person skills for SafeCall. Mm-hmm. And I usually get calls safe through SafeCall, have 911 operators, firefighters, cops, prosecuting attorneys, or in some states it'd be called district attorneys, and family members of law enforcement. It's confidential information. The problems I usually get are after a shooting, police officer calls, or in a case where there was shooting and a police officer didn't shoot, and how guilt the person felt for not shooting. So that was a new phenomenon for me, guilt by not shooting. I mean, you as a cop would know more about that, but that was pretty fascinating. So I got I got some more calls on that. I have financial problems, of course, relationship problems, problems with their children in reference to, and cops usually, authority.
Yeah.
The financial, usually firefighters, a lot of pornography, use of drugs, suicidal ideation, individual calls, and I'm talking not just from the state of Washington. The furthest I got was people from Chicago calling.
Yeah, your hotline is nationwide, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah. So Sean is doing a fantastic PR work. And so anyway, I got one from Chicago having to do with a person who felt that he made an error and somebody was killed, and so what I did with that individual, what I try to do with the individuals who are in crisis is first listen to what they have to say and then help them to identify their internal and external resources. Internal first. What resources have you used in under crisis? Where, what I call first base. Where do you run to first base to cool yourself down after an incident? And then, so we focus on that, and then I reinforce that, and then their external resources.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I usually have them, I usually talk to them for about an hour on the phone, and then I make an appointment to talk to them maybe the next day on the phone again. Or the option is, for a lot of these people, call me 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but otherwise, let's just have a scheduled telephone. And most of the telephone interactions, the longest I've had was 8 weeks. Usually it takes 2 to 3 for me to help them identify their external resources, and then they gravitate to their external resources rather than to me.
Right.
I've worked with wives in reference to one of the biggest problems is the officers and firefighters don't date their wives. Well, they might date somebody else, but they don't date their wives. And so we develop with some wives the possibility, and finances is one of the biggest things, or they don't want to keep using their neighbors to watch the kids. So we talked about the family, the wives getting together and have a co-op where they take turns watching kids so that the people can go date that night.
Yeah.
And also we talked about the union or the guild have an extra money set aside for people to draw on to pay for a babysitter, because even with a co-op, you burn out each other, you know, and so you need that. So that's to get the wives or significant others, because it could be a husband too now,
right?
To have some relief from the kids so they can go out and date. As you well know, John, that's a major resource, the family, and a significant other. You lose that, which I did, I know firsthand, too. It's a major setback for you, and it puts you more in a panic state. I also talked about ride-alongs. See, I never had my wife go out with me.
Mm.
We had a policy we couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to some chiefs around here, police chiefs, about letting the officers' wives go with them. And one of the arguments was, well, yeah, we let wives go, but not with the officer, the husband, because, you know, they're concerned that's going to be a distraction. And my argument, after listening to police officers and all, you're concerned about the safety. I tell you what, I would be willing to bet that police officers who take out their loved ones in the car, they're more safe than if without the wife there, because they want to protect her.
Yeah.
And so, and one of the chiefs never heard that argument and said, yeah, well, that's a strong argument. We're going to take it to the guild and talk to them about it. But again, keep that family unit together. You're going to keep people within law enforcement. You lose that, the higher probability you're going to lose people that are trained. It takes millions of dollars to train these people over a period of time. So that's what I've been doing, John.
Is that all? Yeah, you have a fascinating background. I have the advantage of having been able to talk to you before, and I'm just, I don't think we're going to be able to cram everything that I've heard into this interview, but I thank you very much for being willing to come and share your insight with the audience. Before we go too far, I want to, you know, one of the things that bonded us together is that I, in my reference at a meeting to law enforcement, I included probation and parole. And I try to be inclusive. I know that there are so many branches of law enforcement out there. I probably don't mention them all often enough, you know, corrections and sheriffs versus police officers and everything. But you actually really picked up on that, and I can tell that it's kind of a sensitive issue.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, because we are the bastard child. As I said, you know, cops don't like us because we're social workers. Social workers don't like us because we're cops. And we're forgotten. In a lot of states now, parole officers, and now in our state, they have the option to carry firearms. And so since, I guess, because we weren't carrying firearms, we weren't considered law enforcement. But I tell you what, in the 70s and 80s, police officers literally would call me at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, we understand this guy's a parole officer. We have him, but it can't stick. What can you do for us? Well, I can get out of bed and go arrest him. Because all I have to have is a gut hunch that the person's committed a crime. Of course, cops love that.
Yeah.
As long as I'm my own agent, I'm not the agent of them. I have those powers. And so the cops liked us because of that, but they didn't really consider us, good or bad, I don't know, of being law enforcement.
Yeah.
You know, so we're kind of out of the picture.
Well, when it comes to interacting with the worst of society, it sounds from your experiences that, you know, probation and parole officers don't even get the lull that a lot of police officers or detectives get when they get to deal with the good side of society. It seems like everybody you're dealing with has been convicted or, you know, is on the wrong side of the law. So you're not even getting a chance to deal with the good people.
Well, that's a sort of exaggeration, John.
Okay, because I don't mean to generalize.
But what we do is we have first-time offenders who just screwed up. You know, the difference between me and them sometimes, they got caught and I didn't. But in my case, towards the last, I started seeing the worst of the worst of the worst. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But and I didn't have that safety valve of having, quote, normal nuisance criminals.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So yes, you're right in a way, but at the same time, we do have cases that, but by the grace of God, you know, type thing go I.
Right.
And those cases, along with the severe ones, helped our mental health too, because we can see that people were not going to reoffend again.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes in spite of us, not going to be. And so that was our safety valve, where in my case, most of them, I knew were going to, and they did.
Yeah.
Because there were what we call polymorph offenders, many perversions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it also sounds like you really did see the worst of the worst, because when you were talking about some of the major, if you really focused on 10,000 sex offenders, my understanding is they're some of the toughest people to actually reform their behavior, and that's one of the biggest challenges of the criminal justice system. And then when you start talking about serial killers, I think that everybody would agree that's the worst of the worst.
Yes, yeah, and you're right, and that's, and I, you know, of course, it was fun and games for me with these sex offenders because I could be the focal point that, like cops like to be sometimes.
Yeah.
They tell our stories, and but I didn't know that their stories were seeping in into my subconscious mind,
mm-hmm.
and it ended up being my nemesis.
Yeah. So, you know, what brought us together at Springbrook at the Hazelden Center was a group of cops that all have various efforts that are focused toward wellness of the people in law enforcement. And you have had a long career of doing that and are continuing to do that. And so I'm inviting you to share some of your thoughts with the audience about how do we go through a career like this and how do we make this navigation successfully so that I use the term so we can make it to Ali Ali oxen free and live happily ever after, because it's a tough thing to do in modern law enforcement.
Yeah, I think one of the things, of course, I had a lot of time to think about this, and is number one, we have to diversify. All of our friends cannot be in law enforcement. All our readings cannot be cops and robbers, and all our TV. We have to have individuals outside of those areas that we can socialize with. We can go to plays with. We can go to comedies with. We can talk. And one of the barometers that I look for when I hear people say that, if they can go out in 4 hours, 5 hours with somebody and not talk about crime, then that is a good resource person for that individual.
Yeah.
We have to spend time with our loved ones. And I mean intimate time. And intimate time, I mean sharing our thoughts. That's very intimate.
Hmm.
And not trying, as I did, trying to protect them, because I didn't do that.
Yeah.
We need to share time with them. We need to date.
Hmm.
And just have a date once a month, like we did when we were grooming the person we wanted to be with, or we thought we wanted to be with.
Right.
You know, we dated and we laughed and all.
Yeah.
One of the first things a relationship starts going down the tube is when they, a symbol for me that is going down the tube is they're not laughing.
Mm.
And so when they feel that they're in a relationship and they haven't laughed for a while, you know that something needs to change here. That is a great barometer for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of my major yellow lights when I work with firefighters and police officers. When's the last time you really had a good laugh?
Yeah.
And most of them, when I ask that question, they, for about 30 seconds. and you know that, geez, there's something wrong. So when we talked with the wives about having a resource available for them to get babysitters, that is a very strong plus, is because they can date again and they can laugh again. And then they come home after a great laugh, things are not as traumatic as they were before they left.
Yeah.
So I encourage people to do that. To go out and have your hobbies and spend some time with you. And it's just alone for an hour. Fish, quilt, or whatever it is you want to do. Or go ride your horse. Put that on the calendar that you're going to do this. And if I say put it on the calendar, then number one, the significant other gets a chance to see it. Okay, in 3 weeks he's going to be doing or she's going to be doing this. And there's not that conflict. Well, I was going to do this with you today, and you didn't tell me about that.
Right.
And what do you have? You have conflict again.
Yeah.
It's also sharing with your significant other. It's in there. They can see it. And share, 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 share. And when you're through sharing, share some more. That's going to keep the unit together.
You talk about
right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. We talked about ride-alongs too, and all that. But yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a good suggestion. Actually, I started my career in law enforcement, developed my interest in law enforcement by having a friend invite me to come out and ride along when I was in college. In my career, had a number of family members and friends come out and ride with me, and it proved to be very valuable. You talk about yellow lights. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because I think that's where a lot of people in law enforcement miss the boat, because we're so – you even said it yourself. We're caretakers. We're always willing to help somebody else. We want to look out for somebody else in need, and we never see it in ourselves. We ignore those yellow lights.
Okay, let me besides law enforcement, I'll tell you give an example of a yellow light for me.
Okay.
That went I was after I retired, I did volunteer work for Red Cross, the National Disaster Team, mental health person national. Well, of course, 9/11 came, and Red Cross, after the plane started flying, sent me to the Pentagon to work with people who were getting body parts and all. And I was there a month.
Wow.
And one night I came home. Of course, I came home and went to sleep and woke up with a nightmare of my daughter burning. And I, you know, anxiety, deep breathing, sweating and all. And after the panic went away, because usually panic attacks are 1 to, you know, maybe 5-8 minutes, really. I started laughing, and I said, you know, I started laughing because I had a nightmare. I said, you know, that's a yellow light for you, Chuck. You're not taking care of yourself. This is Father's nature way of saying you're not exercising, you're not eating right, you're not getting away from this stuff, you're not talking other stuff. So Father Nature, you're not doing it that way. We're going to dump it this way, and you're going to have nightmares to dump, to get rid of it. And when I looked at it that way, John, I never, ever had a nightmare again.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what I mean by the yellow light. The yellow light was, you know, the nightmares is going to turn red on me if I don't get myself back together again. And so that yellow lights are very positive things. Hmm. It says, okay, you can dump it this way, or you can do what you normally can do. You can write in a diary, which I kept a journal, and I came back with, when I got through typing, 200 pages typewritten journal, just my thoughts and all. And today I have a hard time even reading it because there's a post-traumatic stuff. You know, I get flashbacks. But okay, I dumped that way. I went out with my other mental health people, and we talked, and we went out dancing a couple of times. I went up down the Potomac River for dinner, and I got away from it. I started jogging more or walking. My jogging days were over. I started walking more, exercising more, watching the drinking. It's very easy to abuse alcohol, the drug. I started watching that, and also coffee. I didn't drink so much coffee. And again, like I said, I never had another nightmare. I came back here, and then I was here for a month, and the Red Cross then sent me to New York for a week to work with victims up there for 10 days. Mm-hmm. And again, I didn't have any more nightmares because I those the yellow lights. The yellow lights with my wife, again, number one, I didn't see it. I stopped laughing with my wife.
Yeah.
That was a number one. Another one, I started becoming more aggressive in my driving. Well, gosh darn, we got all those Californians up here. I mean, it's just you have to drive this way. I mean, that dirty thinking. You know, and so that's how I justified, you know, you have to blend into your culture. So that was a yellow light for me. Anger. Just blowing up because the toothpaste lid wasn't on, you know.
Yeah.
Was another yellow light. What I try to do is when I talk to people in crisis, like this, okay, let's go through this and talk about those little, so-called little things, and then we write those down, and then they go and think about it that night and add to the yellow lights, and then we talk about, have them rate, you know, the list, mm-hmm. which is a primary one for you. And they identify their own yellow lights. Mm-hmm. And then they get, and I encourage them to hand that list over to their significant other. But before they do that, have their significant other write down what they consider yellow lights, and then they trade. Oh. And you'll be surprised. I know you won't be surprised, John, but there's some different things on different lists that the person who's going through the trauma didn't see those yellow lights and say, yeah, that's right. And again, it brings the significant other into the relationship, because then they can share again, hey, Chuck, you're going through this. You better, what's going on? Gosh, yeah, you're right. I got a pretty crappy case I'm working on that I'm not going to go into it completely, but it has to do with a child, and it's just gory, and it's, you know, okay.
Yeah.
But at least I talked.
Right. And set the stage with at least a general statement about it.
Yeah. Because, you know, what happens, John, you know, when I come home and I have a bad case, I didn't talk to my wife about it verbally, but we all know that, 80% of communication is body language?
Yeah.
My body language would change, but I wouldn't put words to my body language, and I scared my kids because they knew something was wrong with Daddy, but I say, everything's okay.
Yeah.
And the voice itself gives it away. But
sure.
And also to my ex-wife, nothing, everything's all right. But I was communicating with my body language, and I encourage people to put words with their body language. Otherwise, you can scare, especially your kids, a lot more because they don't know. But if you say, yeah, Daddy had a bad day today, it was really a mess, but Daddy will get okay. I will get okay. Just put the words with what you're saying with your body language.
Yeah.
And you're going to reduce a lot of stress within the family.
So once you've identified some of these yellow lights, what kind of steps do you recommend people take to dealing with it? You talked about journaling and exercise and being conscious of alcohol and coffee intake. Any other suggestions?
Yeah, that's where the individual comes in, listening to the individual. What internal resources have they used in the past? And it gets back to that. Mm-hmm. And then what external resources? Because they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And after I get to identify the internal ones, well, when's the last time you did this? When's the last time you used yoga? Well, about 4 months ago. Well, what do you think about that? Yes, I need to do that. I need to practice my breathing more and all. So let the person, number one, our best resource is our ears, not our mouth.
Yeah.
And listen to people, and they will tell you what their resources are for their yellow lights.
Hmm.
And again, I can't make a map. They have to make the map since it's an individual thing.
Any suggestions on when somebody ought to consider involving a mental health professional? Because I think that's, you know, cops all across the spectrum of law enforcement are so hesitant to admit that weakness for fear they're going to lose their job, that they don't seek professional help when they need it.
Yes. Most of us know that we should have seen a mental health person, but you're absolutely right. You know, they're concerned about that fitness for duty, and I do not do fitness for duty.
Yeah.
I have some police officers who, and they are police officers, who see me. I have a private practice, too.
Uh-huh.
Who pay out of hand, so therefore I don't have to keep a paper trail except for their Social Security number and also that I saw them.
Right.
So I don't have to. And so officers like that, except, you know, one time the officer months later with a fit-for-duty thing to talk to the psychiatrist that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have notes, so... I couldn't really help them out that much because, you know, they flow together.
Right.
So that's one way to do it. But also people tell you, you need to see somebody. And we shove a bat off. Sure, you're the one that needs to see him. You're all effed up, not me. And this projection is a yellow light that they need to identify with. But most of the people, and I don't know if this is your history too, John, knew that they should have seen somebody.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's really up front because we have to be honest with ourselves.
Yeah. And I'll plug again, SafeCall. SafeCall is good there because it's confidential. And remember, if you call from out of state, you're under our laws, and ours have confidential. So they can call, and most times I just know their first name, especially when they start talking about criminal behavior or pornography. I never ask them what the pornography is. Mm-hmm. I just ask them, this is self-medication. What do you get out of the pornography? And then we talk about that. So we can talk about situations without getting specific about it. And again, cops, family, firefighter, 911, POs can use SafeCall. And they don't even know what I look like. I don't know what they look like. So I know that is a tremendous resource now that needs to be used.
Let me give that hotline number. It is area code 206-459-3020. That's 206-459-3020 for SafeCall Now. And that's a remarkable resource. I'll make sure I put that number in the article that goes along with this interview and give people a direct link there. But it's a tremendous resource. We've interviewed Sean Riley, the founder, and have worked with him and have nothing but great things to say. And if I'm not mistaken, Chuck, all of the volunteers that answer that hotline are first responders. They have experience in the field. Many of them are police officers. And I know that that helps to reassure people that when they call, they're going to be talking to somebody that's going to understand what they're talking about.
Yes, yes, yes. Most of us now have walked the streets.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
Yeah.
Chuck, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking time to spend some time with us. You have had a fascinating career, and I can certainly speak probably for the audience. You've made a tremendous impact. I can tell you've made an impact. And you're still doing that, and thank you very much for giving this listening audience an opportunity to get some insights that maybe they wouldn't have gotten without your expertise.
Well, thank you, John. It was a pleasure meeting you at the summit.
Thank you.
Pleasure meeting all those guys. What I tell people, I went to a summit down there from very knowledgeable people throughout the United States. And I tell you what, I would spend probably $3,000 to $4,000 to be in that room if it was a classroom.
Yeah.
It was this, that what I learned and the respect I have for the people who are dedicating their lives is helping families of first responders and the first responders to stay on the job is just commitment. I wish that was there for me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things I have is as I look back on my career, I wish that I had seen some of these things. But then again, it takes us a while to learn. We're a little slow that way sometimes. So I think law enforcement is getting better day by day. And part of the mission here at Cops Alive is to find as many tips, tools, suggestions, and resources as we can to help people successfully navigate their careers in law enforcement, because if you've made that dedication to put on that badge, take that oath, you deserve better, and you don't deserve to suffer all the things that we hear so many of our peers suffering from, the ill effects of stress. So we need to look after each other. We need to take care of ourselves.
Well, thank you, John, for what you're doing. I went on your website after I got back from the summit, and I'm extremely impressed with what you are doing to
Thank
keep
you.
People healthy.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're going to put me out of a job, which is good.
I don't think so, not anytime soon. But it's a good goal because, we really need to start taking care of ourselves.
Yes, yes we do.
All right, thank you, Chuck. You have been listening to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. And I just want to remind you, CopsAlive.com was founded to provide information and strategies to help police officers successfully navigate their careers. And we work with law enforcement officers and their agencies to provide training and insight, resources and tips, just like this podcast and the things that we put on the Internet to try to help you. And it is about cops helping other cops survive. So if you have suggestions for us or ideas for stories, you want us to come to your organization to do training, please contact us. And until then, stay safe out there and stay alive.